Success Mobile. See you. I'm good, just making my way down to Lawrence. No one. It doesn't look that way. I don't know. I didn't really look at the weather.
Up a while ago. It was well before it hit Greenville. But looked like it was going to be bad. But then I finally get out the door and it's just barely raining.
Yeah, I came to a little bit when I left Greer, or Gurr. And I'm on 101 here, heading towards Lawrence now. Just going down to play some music.
Do you mean actually playing it or just... like a DJ type thing or what?
Nope. I play guitar and bass. I brought my bass this time. I'm just helping a friend of mine out. They got a little open jam going on down here. He's a drummer. So I'm bringing my bass down and a little bit of PA gear. Just, it's an inside thing. So going down and enjoying myself a few hours. Oh, heck no. And tomorrow night I'll be up in the Sebastian. Spartanburg. I'll be up in Spartanburg jamming again.
Spartanburg.
It's at a place called Shake and D's, a little bar and grill up there. I couldn't tell you what part of town it's in. I just know how to get there.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it's kind of, I think it's on like the north side of town, or it's off of 585. But don't quote me on that.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm the same way, though. I know how to get around, but I can't tell you what every road name is.
Maybe long enough. But if it's a new place to go to, then I'm lost.
Yeah, because I heard Google Maps is apparently down today worldwide. The article, it was like... 10 a.m. to 2, worldwide. I don't know if that was Eastern time or what, but apparently it was down for 4 hours.
I did not know that. Wow. I try and stay the heck off the news.
I'm done with the whole train thing. I'll find myself looking and seeing if there's anything new or new developments. Maybe Russia finally decided to give it up, but so far that ain't been the case. I tried to drive myself crazy with it, so I just get on for a few minutes, check it out, and then leave. But for whatever reason, Google recommended the article to me for Google Maps being down. I don't know.
I didn't even hear about that. I was busy around the house this morning anyway, loading equipment and whatnot. KB2HXS Mobile, south on 101. I think I'm on 101.
South on 85. I hope you don't want to go that way.
No, I take the back roads. I stay the heck off the highways.
Back on 101, and I was checking traffic, which doesn't look bad, but it looked like there was a little right before you got to 101, it was something, but other than that, I didn't see a whole lot of anything. Although the app I use to check traffic is saying there was something going on, but it was moving.
Don't worry too much. Anyway, I'm about 19 minutes from where I gotta be. It'll put me perfect when they're supposed to get there at 4 o'clock, so I left my house a few minutes early with the rain, just in case I ran into any traffic issues. And of course I did.
Sure, yeah. Wouldn't be Spartanburg and Greenville without traffic issues.
I grew up in New York, so I'm used to traffic.
That's worth it. Just Spartanburg Airport or where?
3 years near JFK Airport, so yeah, I know about traffic. That one stretch of Rockaway, I think it is, that I used to call the gauntlet. It runs right by the end of the runway. So yeah, if you're a New Yorker, you're traffic like around here doesn't really bother you much. Although I've seen it double or maybe triple since I've been here, which isn't all that long.
Yeah, me too. It's been a long while since I've been up on Long Island. I was out in Suffolk County. KB2HXS for ID.
People seem to be moving down here. These new neighborhoods going up all the time. KO4, CEF.
Hurst and Lawrence, the Five Towns area, which is probably not very much more than 10 minutes from the JFK Airport. So, yeah, you know, this... This is beginner traffic and beginner driving class. If you want the advanced driving class, drive around there for a while. Or, you know, drive a cab through Manhattan, which I've done. I did a couple of times. Borrow somebody's cab and try to go out for an evening and collect fares. You'll get a lot of driving practice.
Hey, you guys had a great double. The other station, go ahead and take it.
I disagree. There's a lot of people moving down here, a lot of new neighborhoods popping up all the time. KO4 CEO.
Last 5 or 6 years, I've seen nothing but, like in this area near Malden, right now I'm in Fountain Inn, but look near Malden, all up and down, I see all new apartment buildings, new condominiums, new, it's everywhere. I see new building construction going on everywhere. And especially for some reason now, all these big warehouse buildings, big 50 or 100,000 foot warehouse buildings. Are we expecting another 5 BMW companies to move down here? What's with all this industrial and warehouse space and office space?
Let's see if I got this. I don't know. It's a good question. Gentlemen, I'm going to duck out. I'm getting, the repeater's a little noisy to me down here right now. I'm gonna check out. You guys take over for a bit. KB2HXS will be out for a bit.
XS, KD2BNG. Other station if you're in there. Yeah, the repeater is kind of getting... What it is, I think the wind blows up the mountain and moves the feed line on that repeater. That's what the static is.
732, KO4, CEF, and I'll be around for a little while longer. But yeah, I agree. Sometimes the repeater gets a little noisy. Sometimes it just, I don't know. Just deal with it as it happens.
What it is, I think, is their attempt to fix the problem. The antenna's on this, you know, this 400-foot mast that, let's say, has 20 other antennas on it. And it used to be lower down. And I think in attempt to moving it higher, they, you know, the trade-off between additional height and additional impedance of feed line, they should have just maybe left the antenna where it was.
I'll leave that up to Dave. I'm sure he's an expert on that one, W4DJW. But yeah, I just, every once in a while, I mean, you can see how weather definitely affects it and whatnot. But
DJW is definitely the guy who would know. But, you know, that's what I had heard at one time is, yeah, the trade-off between a few hundred additional feet of height and the extra impedance of the feed line. Also, I think you moved it closer to where the other antennas were. So now you've got these 20 other antennas creating intermodulation distortion. You know, the police departments, fire departments, TV relays, I don't know what they got up there. But, you know, things like that. Yeah, Dave's the expert on the repeater. He knows more than anyone.
Repeaters and whatnot, you get well over my head. I do good to keep up with my antenna stuff. I couldn't imagine trying to keep up with the one on the repeater.
One of the better repeaters. Now, there's another repeater I got programmed in here as the same call sign, W4NYK. I think it's mostly disused. It's on 145.8 or something. It's on the other mountain. Whichever Paris Mountain or Caesar's, whichever mountain this isn't on, the other mountain. But there's another repeater for this club, but I hear no traffic on it. I think it was the repeater that was originally up there for phone patch. 1458 something or 164, what am I saying? Yeah, 14582 maybe. Can't recall the frequency off the top of my head.
Control.
It's the other club repeater, the other W4NYK repeater. It's mostly disused. It's on the other mountain, whichever mountain this one's not on. And it was originally there for phone patch. you know, when phone patch was still a thing. But it's mostly disused now. No, Mount Mitchell is on probably a good 100 miles east of here on, well, you know, on Mount Mitchell.
Yeah, this repeater is on Caesar's Head. The other repeater's on Paris Mountain, and it's 146.82.
146.82, and it's kind of like the other Blue Ridge Radio Club repeater. It's mostly disused now, though. I don't hear hardly anyone on it. And I think someone was saying, or I'm, you know, I heard someone else saying, when you had a phone patch circuit there, which might still be there, it was very, very much used for that, but not used a whole lot anymore. But, you know, still there. If this one ever gets, you know, too busy or has some other problem.
Came out.
That prescription to pick up in a few minutes. So let me get out of here as well. All right, if there's anyone left, it's KD2BNG. I'll be clear.
3TKO4CF, and I'll be standing by for a little while longer.
Mobile.
For CEF, how you doing, Dave?
That'd be for DJW.
Better memory than I do.
Who that was. When Gary, W4EY, Gary started putting out videos on how to get your license, we got an onslaught of new operators. So there's a lot of new names and call signs to remember.
They remember voices long before I remember names. That's why I'm glad we wear them on our shirt at work.
That makes it easy. That's too easy.
But it definitely helps. I forget somebody's name after I hadn't seen them a while. I just glance down real quick and remember who they are.
German engineers over there?
We'll have German planners. A lot of the engineers stay at the FITs and those areas. I don't know if they stay in the cylinder, but yeah, they mostly stay over there. But we get a lot of the German planners, and of course, you get a lot of the upper management's German.
German engineers, he flew RC airplanes and helicopters and multirotors. He did it all. He was, we did a lot of flying together for the two and a half, three years that he was here on stage, but now he's gone back to Germany. I don't see him anymore. His name is Michael. This was back in 2013 through 16. Were you working there at that time?
I've been there since 1999.
You might have known him. He was like one of the lead guys for their sensors in cars. So he'd drive cars around that had sensors in them. He had other people that did that too. I mean, he had a whole team. And they measured, he'd take brand new cars, you know, concept cars. They still had all that, those stickers on them that made them look like zebras so that you couldn't tell where the curves on the car were. And he'd be driving those around. When they came out with that first electric car that they had, he took me for a ride in it. And that was some impressive at BMW.
Definitely built some impressive cars. And where they've always usually lacked is kind of the interior, like radio, kind of that kind of stuff, but usually like the powertrain and suspension and whatnot, man, they've always been spot on with that.
He asked me why I had a Nissan rather than a BMW. I told him my whole life my sisters had BMWs, and I just considered a BMW a girl car. He did not like that at all. He said, that's when he brought that muscle car out there and said, now, is that a girl car? No, that's not a girl car.
Oh, yeah, that's funny. It used to be. I mean, you rarely ever saw people driving BMWs. And then once the plant came in, then you see it a lot more. But, I mean, they're definitely a lot more common. A lot more people drive them. And, you know, they appeal to almost every demographic now. And, shoot, they've got entry level all the way up to $100,000+ if you're willing to spend that kind of money on a car.
That's for people who aren't interested in recouping their investment. They don't care. They got enough money not to worry about having to recoup. Like a Tesla, same way. But I'm not to that point yet, anyway, or at least not with a vehicle. But they do make good cars, and he gave me an education on them, a really good education on them. Kind of like when Michelin first came back in the 70s, Michelin came to the United States, and South Carolinians got an education on tires that other states never, ever even could imagine.
Right on that, because my dad worked at Michelin probably 30 years. Would tell me all about them, and, you know, he'd watch stuff where Michelin, you know, tires were big, you know, whatnot, and he would talk all about them. But, yeah, I can definitely see it. And, you know, one thing I like about working BMW, not everything they make I like, but they made some really nice products, and I used to love riding in the roadsters, take them up to the mountains and just have a good time with them.
For the ones that he brought over, but it was all electric. He brought to the airfield. I was flying out of Western Carolina Radio Club back then, down at 417 and 101, and he used to bring them out there, and we'd go for rides. We'd be out in the country, so he wouldn't hold anything back. accident over here at Wade Hampton, on 101. They're going north on 101. Something going on.
Excuse me, unfortunately, people don't know how to drive in the rain, but, well, Dave, I am pulling in the driveway, so I'm going to say 7-3. It was good talking to you for a little bit, and hopefully we'll catch you on the radio again. KO4CEF, and I'll be clear on your final.
All right, Andrew, well, enjoy the official start to your weekend. KO4CEF, W4DJW Mobile.
Harold TR, there was a big wreck all around between 1 and 2 o'clock at the bottom of the hill there, just past the fire department. If you were coming from my house, you cross the bridge and you turn there before you get to that little community, you know, the tiny community. And that's where the wreck was at. So I turned around, went around. I went over to 14, went down Wade Hampton to Lowe's, went in, got my stuff, come out and drove all the way back, and when I got back, it was still blocked, clear up there to the first filling station south of us. And the mailman had been here an hour or so before that. She was just now getting there. So I think there might have been somebody killed there at the bottom of the hill right there at that bridge.
And Cunningham right there on scene, that's not a good place to get in an accident because a lot of congestion in that area. It's better than it used to be, but nowhere as good as it was before they started messing with that intersection at the top of the hill.
Well, but they come down that hill real fast there, and if somebody pulled out, you know. You know the name of that drive, Bernice? I can't think of it. We go up that street and go up to our doctor's up there at Memorial Drive up by McDonald's there. Well, we turn there a lot of times and go up the country way past the lake. Man, they come down a hill fast.
I used to take Jeffrey over there when he was little. His girlfriend lived at the first intersection after you turn off of 101 on that road and you go toward Greer. Her last name was Ouvidas. I remember the Ouvidases. I met her mom and dad. And Jeffrey would want to go over there, so before he had a license, I'd have to take him over there. So I know that area pretty well.
Good. But, boy, I'm telling you, that's sad. And I don't know what they're going to do about that. You know, I heard the Bernice was out in the backyard, and she was, we got these pavers that are about a foot by foot square, and she was adding some to the south side of the chicken pen there. And she wanted me to go to town and pick up some big spikes so they would stay in place. And I heard the fire department that go out. You know, I don't even know how they get out of that fire department there. It's so congested anymore.
Rely on people getting off on the shoulder, and there's not a whole lot of shoulder to get off in those areas right over there by that mill where the old mill wheel was, the water wheel. And all the way up the hill there, and then down the other side, there's just not a whole lot of shoulder to the road. So, yeah, that would be difficult.
On up the road there, one day just past the mill, before you get to that next big intersection, I call it, there's some kind of a Butler building, refrigeration building there now. They just built, but you can turn left there and go back over to 14. There was a semi-truck got off in that real twisty curve just the other side of Willis's when you're going south. And the back end of that trailer was off in that culvert. And I'm telling you, I followed a drunk driver down through there one day, and I was on the phone with the sheriff's department. And they never did get a guy out there. But at any rate, there's no place to go. You just don't have a choice. You're kind of trapped. It's in 0TR.
Amy goes up that way when she goes to work. Instead of going out by Ingalls, instead of going out Rutherford to 290 and 290 out to 101 out to Wade Hampton, she goes the back way and goes up that road you're talking about. And I told her that. She said sometimes it's really, really crowded. Sometimes she goes left when she gets down to the bottom of the hill toward your house. Sometimes she goes right, just depending on how backed up that light is. And then if she goes right, then she turns before the old fire station. I don't know if you know, if you go around that curve past that place you were talking about and start going up the hill, there's the old Cunningham Fire Department on the left. And just before that, you can cut across. I think that's Ansel School Road. You can cut across over there. And so that's her two ways to go from here, is to get out to Wade Hampton to head over to Spartanburg.
That building I was talking about, there's some other business in there now. In fact, I think it might be a data business of some kind. But I didn't realize it was the old fire department, Dave. We just been here 12 years. But that's what I went back up when I got down to that intersection where that where you turn off and go up old Rutherford Road or whatever. I just turned around and went back and at the stoplight and turned there at that old fire station, went over to 14 and come home. So I drove 20 miles instead of 10. But they were backed up still after an hour or so, clear up to that dollar store there on the top of the hill. Yeah, that's kind of a pretty drive through there, and the one along Lake Cunningham's a pretty drive. But you know, there can be a heck of a line of traffic there at that stoplight, but they got the PLCs programmed right. When they move cars, they move a bunch.
I have noticed that when I turn off onto that road, I'm at the bottom of the hill and traffic's not moving. Yeah, but when the light goes green, I'm thinking, come on, guys, come on, let's go. Giddy up, go. And they go, and I make it through the light from the bottom of that hill at a standstill in one green, in one light's worth of green. So that is pretty good that they let that many cars go through, and that people are, you know, they're not reading their cell phone and just sitting there burning up green light.
Burning up people like me. When I see that, it just, oh. And the one up there by Taylor's Orchard there at the corner, if you go on straight from our house, clear up to where it gets Locust Hill, at that stoplight, they'll be sitting there messing with their phones, and that one's short, and they'll make you miss your light almost every time, and oh, my seats are burning.
You're on nudge them a little bit. Or nudge the car that's behind them, that's in front of you. You know, oftentimes they'll become conscious right before it turns yellow, and they get through and everybody else has to sit there. That's what burns me up.
I'm 100% with you on that, Dave. Well, I don't know where you're at, but what's the weather look like out there? I heard a little rumble of thunder, but I went and looked out our window towards the west, and it just looks like it's overcast.
I'm on the west side of the airport. Going into the airport to pick up Amy. Her flight lands in 15 minutes, and it's raining. It's just rain. It's not a whole lot of wind or anything. I just saw there's a private plane just took off a jet So he's climbing out. It's not so bad they can't come and go. She said the pilot said, buckle up, it's going to be turbulent when she left Chicago. Hopefully they make it here and she's not too bruised up by the turbulence. But it's just rain is all it is. And it's plenty of it. It's a lot of rain. But it's 4 o'clock, so it's not, everybody's not off work yet. So traffic's not so bad at this point. Maybe going home, that'll be different.
We come in there one night, and it was a thunderstorm. And I mean, it was pretty turbulent, and I've been in some turbulent places landing on carriers and that. And you know, when we got off the plane, I was a little skeptical about him making the approach, but I think they're the highest class of ILS there is, Dave. And anyway, the pilot and co-pilot was walking by me with their suitcases, and I said, hey, fellas, you know, I've made some pretty good landings when the visibility was less than 200 feet and a half a mile. I said, when did you break out? I said, that was an excellent landing. But I said, I think I might have had to do a go-around there. And he turned and kind of smiled at me. He says, 250 feet. Okay, Dave, repeat your last. You were covered there.
I thought I had that so that it wouldn't send anything out of somebody if it was keyed up less than a minute ago. I have to go look at that algorithm. It's got a flaw in there because I shouldn't go out if the repeater has been in use within the last 60 seconds. I asked if you'd ever been in one that they landed while they were still in the cloud. There was no breakout. The cloud went all the way to the ground.
It's pretty much dead, Dave. The runway was just, you know, in this case, I wasn't looking out the front of the aircraft, whereas in the S2, I could lean over and watch till just before we started to catch the wires and then lock the inertia harness. But looking out of wind as an observer, it was pretty bad. And I've talked to a few that said they could land at zero visibility down there, in all honesty. I'm not certain of that. Wyatt would be the go-to on that.
Fires, do you mean on an aircraft carrier?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were just 4 of us on that plane. And as we landed, it was 200 feet and a half a mile. And I remember Lieutenant J.T. Jeffries trying to land, and they had switched places up in the air, and Jeffries made 2 passes at the carrier, and every time he did, I could look out my portal, and I'd see the TACAN tower on the carrier. I could see the bridge, but looking out the front window, I couldn't see the carrier until we was way below minimums. So they went back up to a certain flight level, 1,200 feet, or I don't know, probably higher than that. And then they have to move the airborne integrated display out of the way, and the pilot had to back up into our part of the plane and switch positions with the co-pilot. And he got over there, and we were doing the CCA. And as we landed, Captain Beck, he was the old-timer. He was landing, and, of course, we had full helmets on, and I could hear this, and the guy was, I was okay with it until he kept saying, you're below minimums, and that was okay, but he said we was below the fantail, and I didn't like the idea of that. And so he pulled it up just a little bit, and he caught it on the first try. And we was on low fuel quantity, so we pretty much had to land. But you couldn't see that carrier, and we was probably 120 miles an hour, you know, until you was right on top of it.
N4 DJC.
Hey, I didn't realize you were on a carrier when you did that. That is fascinating. I was watching some videos because of all the war stuff that's going on. I was watching some things about weaponry, and I saw some mishaps when landing on a carrier when they were below the fantail and they came on in, and that didn't work out too good. Go ahead and pick it up, Jerry. W4DJW.
Tom talked about landing on a carrier, and this is not a, it's kind of a sad story, but Lynn's great. Well, actually, Lynn's uncle was on the USS Roosevelt, but he wasn't a pilot. But her great uncle flew an F-4F, and he was on board the Yorktown in World War II, and he was the XO to Bush O'Hare's flight, and they were doing some training exercises. They'd already been out. I think O'Hare had already shot down two defending the Lexington, and Lieutenant Commander Lovelace shot down one Japanese bomber. They were doing some training exercises between Midway, I think, and the Coral Sea battles, and he landed his plane, and he was taxiing, and one of the trainees came in and missed the wire, landed on top of him and killed him. And, you know, those things evidently, I mean, that's, and we were able to talk to one of them, one of the guys that actually saw it happen years ago. And he said it was just a real tragedy. He said, but stuff like that happened all the time. He said there was so much going on. He said they just didn't have the capabilities they have, you know, now, where they can maybe wave somebody off. But, you know, I don't know where the guy was running out of fuel or what, but it was a real tragedy. But it's just this, when you're talking about not being able to see that carrier deck and coming in, that gave me the heebie-jeebies.
Good afternoon. Yeah, the TACAN tower was up there 300 and some feet, Dave. That's your Omni, but it was TACAN. And they used that, I think, because they didn't want to have planes getting a radio on them to come in. And they could be more directional with it or something, where it looked out towards the fantail. But yeah, I come pretty close. One day we come in and we had a firelight, Dave, just before we were the last one in the Delta pattern. And anyways, Captain Beck said, Rousey says, I got a firelight here, and I knew we was on low quantity fuel because we'd been working with a submarine out between San Clemente and Santa Catalina. And he said, should I take this serious? And I said, yeah. I said, you better take that serious, Captain. I said, he says, any smoke aft? And I said, no, there's no smoke here. And he looked back at his VGI, or the gyro horizon, and the one in the captain's position just rolled over, Dave, and it was getting to be dark. So therefore, you know, you can get vertigo after dark, but it was just really dusk, but we was the last one, and he said, emergency, 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 get me the heck down from here, and he didn't say it like that. And we caught the fourth wire, and I guess the next day they told me, and there was a stack blew off. Sometimes that happens when you get a backfire. But we didn't have any backfires or any indication of it. And it was throwing that fire out, that 1,825 cubic inch radial engine, onto the prop feathering pump. And we got the fourth wire, which that's all you have. And the next day in the ready room, they give me a little jigger or something. You should drink that, Ralph. And I drank it. And I'm not a drinker. And boy, it was hot all the way down. He said, you had 90 seconds to live. He said, the wing. Then I started sweating, Dave. Yes, and they're all TR.
Heck. I had a few of those when I was over in France. Not many, but enough to know what that feels like, burning all the way down. But it was good. But what's the G-force on that when you catch that wire? I mean, how many, or do you know, did they ever tell you how? I've always wondered, when that wire hooks, the deceleration G-force has to be tremendous. Did they ever tell you what that is?
Dave, all I can tell you is what you hear is, and that's the end of it. And by the way, the newer ILSs are much, much better, of course. I mean, that's been back in the 60s. But and they call them carrier-controlled approaches. But it's not bad at all, really, on the land. You know, I had a little handle by my left knee, and I could latch my inertia harness. It's like your seatbelt, only more better one back then. And I would lean out and look out the front of the cockpit and watch the landing just before we touched down, and I'd set back real good and lock that in. If you forgot, supposedly it's like the ones in a car. It would grab you from inertia, but you might have your face into an instrument panel, too. But they seem to work real reliably. But on takeoff, I think you get about as many G's out of these carnival rides now at these amusement parks as you did on takeoff. I would say 3.5 G's on takeoff day.
But I would think stopping would probably be up around 8 or 9 or 10 or better G's, because you're going, well, I guess you are slowing down, though. I guess you're pretty slow when by the time you touch and you're going into the wind. So I guess all things considered, you're probably not landing at 400 knots. You're not going from 400 knots down to zero. You're going from like 120 maybe down to zero.
The fastest one at that time was a Vigilante, and it was a reconnaissance plane on the bigger CV-8 carriers. Our carrier was called CVS, or Anti-Submarine Warfare, and the CVAs were attack carriers. And the Vigilante, they called it a Hangar Bay Queen because it had a nose gear that was way out in front of it, kind of like the A3Ds, the heaviest bomber ever on a carrier. And they bust that front wheel a lot of times. And they'd land, I believe, Dave, you have to look it up, 160 knots. We landed at 100 knots. And, if you had a good headwind, and they'd turn the carrier into the wind always. And it was capable of, usually you were doing 23, 25 knots during landings, the carrier was. So, given headwinds out over the ocean and that, it could be, but it was a real hot, steamy day. No, you hit pretty hard. And but you got off real quick if there was a good headwind. Anyways, go ahead, Jerry.
Imagine it'd be kind of tough coming in. But those, it just amazes me. We got the guy across the street from me who's on board a carrier in Vietnam, and a couple other guys I know, they enjoyed it. They said it, after you got used to the noise, if you get used to the noise, after you got used to that sort of thing, they said it wasn't as pretty enjoyable as it is, because they were, during those times, they were far enough out where they didn't have to worry about somebody, it was like being in World War II, where they were landing flights out there, chasing me all over the ocean. But he liked it. He thought it was a good duty. The guys I know did, anyway. Most of them weren't married either, though. That makes a difference, too.
Well, that is interesting. I didn't realize, I mean, I knew you were in the Navy, but I didn't know that you were airborne Navy, Tom.
Carrier very long, Dave, other than carrier calls and that. But I transferred to, went to call duty with brother, and went to a P-3 Orion squadron later. I'd been in that squadron. Well, I went through flight training in VS-41 at San Diego, North Island. And the Australians were my teachers. Boy, those guys, I can't say enough about them. They are strict. And then I went to VS-33, which was my regular squadron, and I was down there about, a year and a half. And I asked for duty was in my brother's squadron up in Moffett Field. And that's where Gary was, I think. Yeah, I know it was. KI-4DOS, but I don't think think he was in a flight crew, but I transferred up there when I made a second-class petty officer up there, and changed my, all the Army calls it MOS, my rating, from aviation electrician mate to aviation and a submarine warfare operator. And so I fit in real well because I had run everything on the S-2 that we had in that four-passenger plane. But there was 13 of us on the bigger plane, and that sucker flew for 13 and a half hours. So I traded 8-hour planes to 13 and a half hour planes. And I'd hang there one night, walked through a propeller. You can't hardly see them on the flight deck, Dave. And they're landing just every, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 seconds or whatever the gap is. It's real close. And one come taxiing up behind us there when we had that fire in the wing. And I was trying to get away from the plane as quick as possible. And that old boy stopped that plane. I'm glad he did. That would have made Hamburger Tom.
Hey, Hamburger left. It might have just made juice on the side of the airplane. Yeah, that would be bad. So were you, I had a buddy when I worked at Michelin, when I was working in the shop, burning Lamel cabinets. He was a retired Air Force, I think. He was a navigator. He's the one that told me the phrase about, I was taking pilot license. That's when I was taking my private pilot. And I was flying just cross country, just trying to build up hours. And he told me, he was the navigator, and he said when he was flying, that he came up with that phrase, hours and hours of boredom interrupted by brief moments of stark terror. That's what I needed to hear when I was doing all my cross country. I never had any stark terror other than one time my instructor pilot shut off our fuel line, and I had to figure out before it went down what I had to do to get it to go back up again. That was right before I soloed. He wanted to make sure if the engine shut off that I would do the right thing. But anyway, James was the guy's name that I worked with that told me about that. What, were you a navigator, or what was your role on the airplane?
This is Gerald TR. Dave, on the S-2, seat number 3, was radar, electronic countermeasures, magnetic anomaly detection for detecting submarines, and radar, electronic countermeasures, mad gear, and your sniffer. And that one I'd have to explain to you. You could sniff out a conventional diesel submarine, and it didn't work very well off the California coast, if you know what I mean. And then I graduated to seat number 4, which was Julie and Jezebel. And Julie was like explosive echo ranging, acoustical warfare, where you bomb the sonar buoys and with small practice depth charges, and you'd bomb one, listen 3, or bomb 5, listen 4, whatever. And the little tetrol depth charges would go down 600 feet and go off. And then on that side also was the listening devices called Jezebel, which I couldn't say that word back then. It was classified. But I thought that was rather humorous. But that was where you do the hydrophones that were down about 600 feet and classified all the different submarines in the world. We had to do it by sight. I'm sure now they just blow the data into an EEPROM and it tells you. Well, you've seen it, Dave, on the Hunt for Red October when that, he was, I think, a second or a first class. He was a black gentleman, and he was telling the captain, you know, that's an Akula-class submarine, and it's doing so many knots and bearing such and such. And these little squiggly lines are up in front of him. That's an acoustical signature. And, if we'd have said something like that when I was in, that was court-martial offense. That was secret. You even had to cover the recorders up at air shows, you know, so people wouldn't see it. But ours, it had little styluses at minus 300 volts, and it burned the signature into paper. And then you take that up to the secret room afterwards and turn it in of the signatures of, well, you had it memorized orally, all the submarines in the world, and the acoustical characteristics of those submarines, Dave.
Interesting. I didn't have any idea. Jerry, you still there? Go ahead, W4DJW.
Yeah, well, Dave, that is interesting. I've never, of course, all that stuff was secret back when we were younger, so we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't know about it till now. But that's really interesting. That is, especially the burning the paper. I could see it happening right now, Tom.
Well, funny was when you was green and didn't know any better, they give you a lead pencil, and you'd lean over and look down at the chart where those styluses were, and you would put little scratch marks on different characteristics of that submarine. Well, I thought minus 300 volts ain't going to hurt you any, and that pencil has a nice lead in it, and it'd wake you right up if you happened to touch one of those styluses, Dave.
Was a tech guy back in those days, Tom, moving up through the ranks. Tussle in front of me is about ready to move. A Clemson Tiger bus pulled up beside me, and I got a curb on the other side, so I'm all boxed in here. And I'm watching Amy. She just flew over Mount Mitchell, so their flight's late. And that Tussle wants to back up, and there's no way for me to back up. So he's stuck. I'm stuck. Anyway, I sound like you were the tech guy, Tom.
My radar detector so well, Dave. It reads out in frequency, and I can tell you, listening, I had to memorize all the different radars in the world on the S2. On the S3, or on the P3, we had more sophisticated scopes that we could analyze the Russian, primarily Russian radars with, but anybody's, to see, display all the parameters, whereas on the S2 it was more or less a direction finder. So what they did in the trainers, you would have to memorize pulse repetition frequencies, pulse widths, rise times, things like that. And so I can still tell you today what a MiG-21 sounds like, or a MiG-15, or a backfire bomber, and I can tell you what type of radar he's got. And the P3 was much more sophisticated, but you still orally heard it as well as seen a lot of parameters that I would rather not say. But it was very interesting, and I ran that on the P3 along with Julie for a while. But I don't think Julie'd be a good thing now, because you start dropping practice depth charges on your sonobuoys, and those submariners might take that in the wrong way. They were very loud.
Pulse width to identify what the type is, you should be very comfortable with Raspberry Pi. They have a general purpose input output pins that use pulse width to send signaling throughout the programming on a Raspberry Pi. That should be something you would be right at home with.
I'll tell you this much, though, Seth. KA-band radars that all of these officers run around here in their cars with now. And by the way, there were three of those motorcycles up on White Hampton the last several days. That it has a very high pulse repetition frequency and a very short pulse width. And it's very, well, it's much more sophisticated than the fire control radars that were aboard foreign aircraft back then, or even ours for that matter. And their phased array now, which I don't know anything about the phased array radars, except they don't rotate. They rotate it electronically, Dave.
Doppler direction finders. Have you heard of the Doppler direction finders? Using rotating antennas, but they're physically still, but they're electronically rotating.
Surprised. The only place we used Doppler, in fact, the S2 is one of the first things we got new, was radar altimeters. And they were only good to 5,000 feet. I don't know how high they go now, but Those were really nice when you was flying over the Salton Sea. We had radar targets there, and I would guide the pilot in at the radar target, and then at 2 miles, he'd turn on a 70 million power arc light out on the wing and light that target off. And I think it was 200 and some feet below sea level. So as you well know as a pilot, that barometric altimeter wouldn't do you much good.
70 million candle power looks like from an airplane down on the ground. I mean, does that light up a pretty big spot?
Oh, you could go down and we'd, like if we were running in on a merchant ship or something, especially over Vietnam, but here too, you could light off the whole ship. It's like a big carnival light. The P-3s had them also, but it's an arc light, and it's got two carbon arc rods inside of it. And you had to be careful if you lit it off and it give a circular pattern. There had been instances where it burnt the wing off. But you'd light a submarine off at 2 miles and you could see him on the surface or a snorkel. And you could read the nationality off the stern of the ships at night. And then as we got closer, like on that radar target in the Salton Sea, we would drop what they call a photopod. And they were black powder, I think, or something like that. And the reason I say that is we'd taxi down to the armorers, and they would not put that on until the pilot and the co-pilot stuck both their hands up out through the emergency escape hatches in front. And then there was no radio transmissions by us or them. And they'd load those on. And when we dropped those over the ship, it would actually shutter the aircraft or over that radar target. So when you got back, it would show that you had a successful mission, like if you were doing a practice mission over that radar target in the Salton Sea. And it was 100 million candle power a day, said 0GR.
How long did that 70 million candle power last?
You had a lot of air going over them because it hung below the wing. I can show you a picture of it next time you come over here. Or else just look up S2 Tracker. And they later on come out with a jet version of it, an S3. But, you know, you're down there. Our minimums were 100 feet in the daytime and 300 feet at night. So you're down real low when you're approaching a ship or something pretty fast. So I don't think you'd want to leave that on too long. It wasn't necessary.
I mean, they could turn it on and off. It wasn't a once and done.
Oh, no. No, you could use that all night on your patrol. The S2 is, a normal patrol was 8 hours, and a normal patrol on the P-3 was, 13 to 13 and a half hours.
Once and done. Go ahead, Jerry.
That's what I was thinking too, Dave. It was a once and done thing, but that's a bright light, like they say. I can't imagine 70 million candle power. That stuff is N4 DJC Friday.
Yes, Dave, we're just at once, you know, to take a picture. And if he was a bad guy, well, you'd send that over. When he was overseas, you'd send it to Japan and the big carriers to take care of the bad guys. But guys, I gotta go. It was a pleasure reminiscing. That's been over 50 years ago, Dave. But you remember things like that, kind of like that guy shutting off your fuel. Bernice has got some nice fish over here that's coming off of the stove, and I need to go eat. And see, it's been great talking with both of you. 73s, be safe out there. It's W4DJW to take it in 0TR.
To you, and sometime I got to get over there to set up and before I come over there to set up your database, and which one you need to decide which one's primary, which one's secondary, which one you use the most, and which one is on when you're on the other one, so that I can get the right one set up. So think about how you want to do that. You don't want your P3 primary to be off when you're on your secondary or vice versa. Anyway, take care. Enjoy your fish. N0TR, W4DJW.